Turn, if you will, back to Genesis. We'll continue with our reading from Genesis. We want to look at a couple of days specifically this time, and we're going to talk about the different kinds that God is talking about in here and look at that and see exactly what that means and what it means to us as we have a better understanding of creation, of the biblical authority that we have. As far as science is concerned and all the different things that go with that, we find that the Bible indeed is not against science, but really the Bible is the Bible of science. And if they would look at that, they'd figure out where we came from pretty quick. As we've been looking at it, we've looked at a couple of days, but let's, in verse 9, he says, "Then God said after," he said, "so the evening and the morning were the second day." In the first chapter, the ninth verse, he said, "Then God said, let the water under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind." We're going to look at what that means as we go through this. "Whose seed is in itself on the earth, and it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, and the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind. And God saw that it was good, so the evening and the morning were the third day." And then in verse 20, it says, "Then God said, let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens. So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves with which the waters abounded according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good, and God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the water in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. So the evening and the morning were the fifth day." One thing I would say, well, a little more, verse 24. "Then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping things, and beasts of the earth, each according to its kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind." So everything was according to its kind. What's marvelous about that, as we see this, God is not just telling us how they reproduce, the birds, the animals, the fish, and all of them after their kind. In other words, God not only shows us the reproduction of the animal kingdom and all that is entailed in that, but it also sets a boundary there, if you'll see that. Even in the plant life, it says the seeds contained in it, and it brings forth what it brings forth. It's not going to bring forth something else. You're not going to go to an apple tree and find cantaloupes hanging there. That'd be convenient sometimes, just pick a cantaloupe off a tree. But that will never, ever happen in the natural way of things, the way God has set it up, because he set a boundary in it that it'll bring forth only its kind, the way he designed it to be. Very important that we look at that and understand that, because the evolutionists would have us to believe that's not so, that we all came from the same thing. We came from some soup somewhere, and some disagree with that. And as we go along, we're going to see a lot of disagreement with a lot of the scientists. And a lot of them will admit that there must be a creator if things happened the way it did, if it did, and I always put an if in there because they're not going to embrace that. But they'll actually, in what they're saying and what they've tried to find out all through these years, is that they can't create life, and they still can't tell you where life came from as far as they're concerned. But we can. We have the Word of God. The Word of God tells us that God spoke life into existence. We'll see in a few weeks where he gets man out of the dust of the earth. That ought to tell us a lot about where we came from, the dust of the earth. And we're going to go back to the dust of the earth, it says. And then our spirit will depart, be with God. One day we'll be given a new body, fashioned for heaven and immortal glory. And it, It doesn't take as much faith to believe that as it does what the evolutionists would have us to believe, some of the crazy things that they come up with. But anyway, as we look at that, we find God telling us how everything reproduces or how it comes forth from a particular kind, but also it's bound to that kind. In other words, a fish will never produce a bird. It never will. Evolutionist says, well, I don't know about that. You know, we all evolved, but they're still lacking something. They still lack that missing link from a human to an ape to a human. They don't have the link or the skeletal systems that show you where a bird grew wings. I mean, a fish grew wings, and where fish grew legs and walked on the face of the earth and became. They lack that particular piece of the puzzle. And so that leaves a hole in their theories altogether. Of course, they're always presenting their theories as fact, and that's what's being taught to our children throughout the world, and even Christians embracing that to try to fit their theology into God's theology, and it won't fit. It just won't work. So we'll look at that today, and we want to see, to start with, how evolutionists explain how life began. We want to see that and see what they had to say about that, and we'll get there if I can find it again. Job 33:4, you don't have to turn there, you can if you want to. This tells us what we believe and what Job understood. Remember, Job's the oldest book in the Bible, actually. It's not, it would be if you put the books according to their age, Job would be the first book, but God in his wisdom put Genesis there first so we would understand where all the origins come from. That's the reason it's so important for us to understand the truth about Genesis and everything that God spoke and did, because it affects what we believe on down the road in the rest of the Bible. But Job says in 33:4 what we understand to be the truth. The Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life. So if an evolutionist wants to know where life comes from, tell the next one you run across to look at Job 33:4. It's an answer for them. And they can look in Genesis and Deuteronomy and Ephesians and Romans and all the rest of them. They'll find out where it comes from. So here they say the origin of life. And this is what they propagate, or what they put forth for us to believe about life. He said the theory of biological evolution requires that non-living chemicals somehow developed completely by chance into highly complex living organisms. Now listen, Brent, it takes more faith to believe something like that than it does to believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen. It really does. I mean, you think of that. Something non-living becomes living. And this is what their whole premise is. That it has to be, because they say that we evolved from some cell somewhere, and they look at it as simple cells. They find out now with all the technology they have that simple cell is not as simple as they thought it was. Very complex. Very complex. One single cell. You think of how many cells it takes to make up the human body, and the things that they espouse or they put before us, we see just don't add up. It just doesn't make sense. So the theory of biological evolution requires that non-living chemicals somehow develop completely by chance into highly complex living organisms. However, non-living things coming to life is the stuff of science fiction, not science. Louis Pasteur's famous and repeatable experiments have demonstrated the law of biogenesis, that spontaneous generation is impossible, and that life can only arise from other life. Scientists have spent decades trying to create life in the laboratory in carefully controlled experiments and have repeatedly failed. Now, that's in carefully controlled experiments. In other words, they pulled all their resources and honed it to try to make life, but they're telling you that all this came by chance. So all that wasn't available in the beginning, so it even makes it more impossible when we think about it. With all that they have to create life, God's still the only one that creates life. Amen. And that's what we know to be so. He said they have repeatedly failed. If highly intelligent scientists using all the latest, most sophisticated equipment available cannot create a living cell, even with the code and materials of life available to them, how could molecules possibly assemble themselves into living cells through only mindless, undirected, random chance? So we don't even believe in chance. So I, you know, that's what their whole premise is on, is chance. And it just happened. It just somehow or another happened. The famous astronomer and mathematician Sir Frederick Hoyle calculated the probability of the spontaneous generation of life. No matter how large the environment one considers, life cannot have had a random beginning. And he gives a good little example here. Troops of monkeys thundering away at random on typewriters could not produce the works of Shakespeare. We believe that. For the practical reason that the whole observable universe is not large enough to contain the necessary monkey hordes, the necessary typewriters, and certainly not the waste paper baskets required for the deposition of wrong attempts. The same is true for living material. The likelihood of the spontaneous formation of life from inanimate matter is one to a number with 40,000 noughts after it. I would say it'd be higher than that. I'd just keep on putting those noughts out there. It is big enough to bury Darwin and the whole theory of evolution. There was no primeval soup, neither on this planet nor on any other. And if the beginnings of life were not random, they must therefore have been the product of Percival intelligence. Certainly we believe that. We believe that God created life. In Darwin's time, it was assumed that the simple cells were just primitive blobs of protoplasm. So it wasn't too hard for scientists to envision them assembling by random chance. Because cells cannot be seen with the naked eye, scientists mistakenly thought that the chemistry of life was simple. But with today's sophisticated microscopes, molecular biology has shown how vastly complex even a simple cell actually is. Molecular biologist Michael Denton, an evolutionist, acknowledges, although the tiniest bacterial cells are incredibly small, weighing less than 10 to the 12th power grams, not much weight, each is in effect a veritable micro-miniature factory containing thousands of exquisitely designed pieces of intricate molecular machinery, saying one cell is made up of something that we can't even wrap our minds around. Made up altogether of 100,000 million atoms, far more complicated than any machinery built by man and absolutely without parallel in the non-living world. That's one cell, and they would have you to believe that all this by chance came together and formed and fashioned life as we know it. Not only are there experiments demonstrating how life could have come into being, but the more scientists search for answers, the more they are astounded at the complexity they find, and the more the evidence confirms that life could not have arisen purely by chance. Geochemist Jeffrey Botta from the San Diego Scripps Institute points out the evolutionist's ongoing dilemma concerning this question. Today, as we leave the 20th century, we still face the biggest unsolved problem that we had when we entered the 20th century. How did life originate on Earth? They still don't have the answer for that. In 2001, PBS aired the TV series Evolution, in which they put together all the best information they could find to demonstrate the case for evolution. In a Washington Post online forum, producer Richard Hudson was asked, what are some of the larger questions which are still unanswered by evolutionary theory? He named several items in his response, but the item topping his list is very telling. The origin of life. There is no consensus at all here. Lots of theories, little science. That's one of the reasons we didn't cover it in the series. The evidence wasn't very good. And yet, the whole series was about evolution. And that's the very question that we wouldn't answer if you watch a series like that. But they said we didn't have enough. What we had wasn't very good. The evidence wasn't very good. We can appreciate his honest admission that all they had is theories, no scientific proof. If they had any evidence at all, they would have presented it. Of course, there is no evidence supporting the claim that life arose from natural causes, because life has a supernatural cause. We know that God creates life. Frederick Hoyle also said this: there is not a shred of objective evidence to support the hypothesis that life began in an organic soup here on the earth. So why do biologists indulge in unsubstantiated fantasies in order to deny what is so patently obvious, that the 200,000 amino acid chains and hence life did not appear by chance? So he even says himself that it's an impossibility. And so that's where they stand at that. Here's another evidence that we're talking about, how the scientific evidence supports Genesis creation. This is how it does. He uses a funny example of this. He said the story is told of a symbolic foot race that took place between Russia and the U.S. during the Cold War. The very best athlete from each country competed to see who was superior. The American runner won. The next day, the Soviet newspaper headline read, "Russia comes in second in big race. U.S. comes in next to last." It wouldn't say coming one, but two running. U.S. comes in next to last. They come in first and they come in second. So, if this humorous story shows, your perspective makes all the difference. It's how things are presented. And this is what evolutionists do. They think that they can keep presenting it in such a way, and people will just believe what they're putting out there. But when you look at the facts, there's not very many facts in there that add up to what they want you to believe. If this humorous story shows, your perspective makes all the difference. The way you present the evidence has a great impact on the way it is perceived, and it doesn't affect reality, but it doesn't affect reality. So with that in mind, let's take a close look at an article in the Encyclopedia Britannica describing the turtle's evolution. And they camped on this. They thought this was a great picture of evolution. They used the turtle as an example. The evolution of the turtle is one of the most remarkable in the history of vertebrates. Unfortunately, the origin of this highly successful order is obscured by the lack of fossils. That's our whole problem all the time, is the lack of fossils. They lack that middle part that makes the transition in what they say takes place. Successful order is obscured by the lack of fossils, although turtles leave more and better fossil remains than do other vertebrates. By the middle of the Triassic period, about 200 million years ago, turtles were numerous and in possession of basic turtle characteristics. Now, they had basic characteristics of turtles 200 million years ago. A turtle looked like a turtle. And today, a turtle looks like a turtle. It hasn't evolved very much. They have a hard time with that. Intermediates, and this is the problem, this intermediate part here. Intermediates between turtles and psilosaurs, that's some kind of dinosaur, the primary reptiles from which turtles probably sprang, are entirely lacking. So that sounded like, for the evolutionists, that sounded like some great discovery they made, but let's break it down and look at it. At first glance, this could certainly give the perception that turtles are a marvelous example of evolution. But read it again, rather than the exciting clear-cut proof of evolution that it claims to be, here is what it's really saying. Due to the lack of fossils, there is no clue to the turtle's origin. When it first appeared, the turtle looked just like a turtle, and its structure hasn't changed since. Despite leaving more fossils and better fossils than other vertebrates, there are no intermediate forms. So there's nothing in between that shows a turtle transforming into whatever they say it transformed into. They lack that. Plenty of fossils out there. And they marvel at why they're up in the mountains. We don't marvel at why they're in the mountains. The flood did that. We understand that. Makes sense that the flood did it. And we'll see more about that as we go along. So the turtle arrived on the scene fully formed. Of course it did. God said, let the animals come forth, and all the creatures, the creeping things. Came forth as a turtle. It didn't have to come forth, nothing else. So the turtle arrived on the scene fully formed. There are no fossils linking it to any other creature, and it remains a turtle. Sounds like evidence that would delight any creationist. Yet supposedly, we've just seen one of the most remarkable examples of evolution. Your perspective makes all the difference. Do you see a creature that gradually evolved from less complex life forms linked to its ancestors by numerous transitional forms, or do you see a creature that was created in its own distinct kind and is consistently reproducing after its own kind? That's what we see. We see a turtle bringing forth turtles. They're not going to bring forth anything else. There's different sizes of turtles, different kinds of turtles, but they're all the same kind of turtle. Can't be nothing else. Also, with more and better fossil remains for the turtle than any other vertebrates, but transitional form still entirely lacking, that's because there's not any, what does this say about the intermediates between all other vertebrates? That's their whole thing. When they talk about evolution, they've got to prove it by saying, all right, we evolved from here, we became this, 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 this. But they lack this. They lack that middle part. They can't make the connection. And they lack it for a reason, because it's not there. They think if they keep digging, they're going to find it. But you know, the more they dig, they don't find those. They find more fossils of the same kind. So, what does this say about the intermediates between all other vertebrates? I think the encyclopedia is right about one thing. It is one of the most remarkable examples of evolution available, since no such evidence exists. The nothing they found so far is the best there is. They haven't found anything to make the difference. And so if you'll flip over to 1 Corinthians, you wouldn't think this would even have anything to do with it. I find myself amazed as I've been studying this, at some of the things we find here. 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter. We already automatically know what chapter it is, don't we? We call that the resurrection chapter. It's all about the resurrection. And that's what we kind of think about. We think, well, I know where he's going there. He's going to talk about the resurrection of the body and all that. What would that possibly have to do with Genesis and what he's talking about, the different kinds that he's talking about? Well, let's see. Ephesians 1 Corinthians 15, verse 39. Now, as Paul is talking about, we're going to get a glorious body, and he'll eventually talk about our final victory being with the Lord Jesus Christ. Look what stands out in here as we go down through that. Let's start in verse 35 when he says, "But some will say, how are the dead raised up, and with what body do they come? Foolish one, what you sow is not made alive unless it dies, and what you sow, you do not sow that body that shall be, but mere grain, perhaps wheat or some other grain. But God gives it a body as he pleases, and to each seed its own body." This is what he says in verse 39. "All flesh is not the same flesh, but there is one kind of flesh." Oh, there's that word kind. "There's one kind of flesh of men, another flesh of animals, another of fish, and another of birds." So he's even saying there that the different kinds come forth as the same kinds. That's what he's saying in this particular part of the body. Right here in the resurrection chapter, wouldn't think it'd have anything to do with that. Evolutionists talk about the Cambrian explosion. That's where they've uncovered so many fossils, but they're all fully formed fossils, and they can't figure that one out. And they happen all of a sudden. They just all of a sudden, and they went to this particular place, wherever it is, I guess different places. I'm sure up in the mountains where they found them. They find all these different fossils, and I guess down deep too. But they're a bunch of them at one time, and they were puzzled at that because they're looking for that transitional form. They're not looking for a big explosion of the same kind of mature or grown animals or turtles or different things. Remember what God said in the beginning. He said, "Let the earth bring forth all these animals." And they went. He didn't bring forth babies. He brought them fully formed, because they had to be what they were. When just like Adam. Adam wasn't but 2 or 3 seconds old, but he looked like a grown man. We don't know how old that is. We know what he was. He was 930 years old when he died. But he had to be a fully formed man, and yet he wasn't but a few seconds old. See, God can do that. And evolutionists can't hack that. They can't handle that. They disallow any kind of miracle. They just won't have it. What they won't have is a true and living God that rules and reigns over them. That's what they won't have. And so they come up with all these different things. But this Cambrian explosion, they thought they had found what they really needed to find. He said, rather than transitional forms between species, as evolutionists claim, what the fossil record reveals is that each species appears fully distinct and remains unchanged. Despite what you've been taught in school, the fossil evidence does not show that all life evolved from a single common ancestor through minor changes. Instead, during the period that paleontologists call the Cambrian explosion, virtually all the major animal forms appeared suddenly without any trace of less complex ancestors. They didn't find anything going up to that point. They just found them all of a sudden. We're not a mystery to us, but to them, great mystery. They're scratching their head. All we got to do is give them a book of Genesis, and they'd quit scratching their head, maybe. No new body plans have come into existence since then. That's the thing about evolution. If we're evolving, how come we haven't evolved any more than we have? It seems like we've hit a stopping place. The Cambrian explosion is also known as the biological Big Bang, because the majority of complex life forms show up virtually overnight. If the entire period of life on Earth was a 24-hour day, the Cambrian period would be less than 2 minutes. Like the Big Bang that supposedly began our universe out of nowhere, nothing suddenly became everything. They can't handle that one. Nothing suddenly became everything. T.S. Kemp, curator of the zoological collection of the Oxford University Museum of Natural History, is one of the world's foremost experts on Cambrian fossils. This is an expert now. In discussing the sudden appearance of new species, Kemp writes, with few exceptions, radically new kinds of organisms appear for the first time in the fossil record already fully evolved with most of their characteristic features present. It is not at all what we might have expected. Took them by surprise. They can't figure that one out. Well, that's because God called them forth. When they called them forth, they're fully formed. Nature clearly does not reveal the gradually changing picture that evolution requires. Instead, life forms are strictly separated into very distinct categories after their kinds. Paleontologists Robert Carroll, an evolutionist of authority, admits this fact in his book, Patterns and Processes of Vertebrate Evolution. Although these are the experts, now they're admitting, these are evolutionists, but they'll admit things like this and they won't change their minds. Although an almost incomprehensible number of species inhabit Earth today, they do not form a continuous spectrum of barely distinguishable intermediates. I can't find them. Instead, nearly all species can be recognized as belonging to a relatively limited number of clearly distinct major groups, with very few illustrating intermediate structures or ways of life. And all the intermediates they find are probably made up. You know, they've made up a lot of them, and they disallowed a lot of them, too. So according to the evidence produced by paleontology, the scientist's guide to whether or not evolution is true, life did not evolve gradually over a long period from single to complex forms. Instead, the fossils show exactly what we would expect to find if biblical creation is true. All the major animal groups appeared fully formed, all at one time, genetically separated into kinds with limited change. Regarding the Cambrian animal groups, prominent British evolutionist Richard Dawkins made the following observation. And we find many of them already in an advanced stage of evolution. They still can't leave evolution alone. You find them in an advanced stage, but he's still calling it evolution. The very first time they appeared, that's what they can't figure out. It is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. That's because there wasn't any evolutionary history. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists. He didn't like to say that, but he said it. Naturally, Dawkins assumes or surmises why there may be a lack of any intermediates and attributes, the very important gaps, or tributes, the very important gaps to imperfections in the fossil record. In other words, they hadn't found them yet. That's what he's saying. We're still digging. We hadn't found them yet. He then adds, if you are a creationist, you may think that this is a special pleading, and he's correct. He goes on to say, both schools of evolutionary thought agree that the only alternative explanation of the sudden appearance of so many complex animal types in the Cambrian era is divine creation, and both would reject this alternative. They just won't have it. Why won't they have it? Because the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God. That's why. They cannot see it. They cannot and they will not see it because they're God haters in their very nature, and they think they're their own gods, and so they keep looking, and it's what God calls that foolishness of men, and as they search, you know, they think that's their wisdom, and God says that's their foolishness. It's foolishness. Dawkins is right. Creationists are delighted that the scientific evidence so constantly, consistently reveals the truth about the origins of this incredible creation. But we would be delighted beyond words if evolutionists would overcome their bias against the truth and acknowledge our incredible creator. Charles Dawkins says this too. The abrupt manner in which whole groups of species suddenly appeared in certain formations has been urged by several paleontologists as a fatal objection to the belief in the transmutation of species. If numerous species belonging to the same genera or families have really started into life at once, the fact would be fatal to the theory of evolution through natural selection. So he admits, if that were so, he still won't say that's so, but he says if it were, it'd be a fatal blow to the evolutionists. Now, we're talking about the kinds here that we've been talking about. Variety within created kind. We want to understand that just a little bit, and we'll close with that. He said, did all species evolve from one common ancestor? Of course, we know that's not true. Genesis 1 repeats 10 times what I read this morning. Repeats 10 times that God created the different types of plants and animals, each according to its or their kind. The word kind is used again in Genesis 6, 19, 20, and 7, 13 through 16, when God instructed Noah to take two of every kind of land animal onto the ark. And in Genesis 8, 17, God commanded these animals to reproduce after the flood. Today's species show the potential variation that God designed within the original kinds. But this variety remains limited. Cats are still cats, and dogs are dogs. And we realize that in the dog animal, there's many varieties. But when Noah filled the ark up, wasn't all those varieties. All those varieties were contained in probably a wolf-type dog or different kind of dogs, but it was still in the dog family. So there's a, and we don't want to use the evolution process, but they did evolve, they moved, they changed, but they didn't change out of what they were. In other words, the dogs had different characteristics, but they were still in the dog family, and that's what he's talking about. He said, what does the word kind mean? So since two of each kind of land animal and seven of some were brought aboard the ark, for the purpose of preserving their offspring upon the earth, it seems clear that a kind represents the basic reproductive boundary of an organism. That is, the offspring of an organism is always the same kind as its parents, even though it may display considerable variation. So there's variation in kinds. Dogs, for example, exhibit tremendous variety. Yet diverse breeds of dogs can produce offspring with each other, indicating that all dogs are of the same kind. Dogs will not interbreed with cats. However, since there are a different kind, modern breeding research therefore confirms the biblical concept of animal and plant kinds. Creation researchers have found that kind is often at the level of family in our modern classification scheme. For example, zebras, horses, and donkeys all belong to the family of the horse family. Yeah, and can mate with each other to form a hybrid animal such as mules from a horse and a donkey, and zonkies. I didn't know they had zonkies. This is new to me. Zonkies from a zebra and a donkey. That's when they mate together. But they're still of the horse family. However, there's no reason to assume a one-to-one correspondence between our man-made system and the biblical terminology. So kind may be at a higher classification level, in some cases lower in others. God placed the potential for tremendous variety within the original created kinds. This original variation, altered by genetic mutations and other mechanisms after the fall, such as natural selection, led to the great diversity of living things that we see today. And so we see the explanation of that as we look at that and understand and begin to understand how we can explain or how we can understand Genesis in the beginning and how God did it. We don't have that problem. But as we look at these things, and that's what I've marveled at, is we've looked at this over and over these past few weeks, and I study it more and more. It's amazing to me how much the scriptures speak about what they should already know. I mean, it just over and over and over, some of these obscure scriptures that seem like they're obscure, and God is telling us, just like the star singing that I used last week, and now the scientists said they radiate a high-pitched sound. Well, that star is singing. God already said that thousands of years ago that they sing, and we're just now uncovering some of what God has shown us. So it's no wonder as we would join with the psalmist in Psalm 145 that we would worship such a God as we have opportunity. He says this, I will extol you, my God, O King, and I will bless your name forever and ever. Every day I will bless you. And I will praise your name forever and ever. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, and his greatness is unsearchable. One generation shall praise your works to another and shall declare your mighty acts. I will meditate on the glorious splendor of your majesty and on your wondrous works. Men shall speak of the might of your awesome acts, and I will declare your greatness. Brother, we don't have to tell one another. We can just look around and we can see the majesty of God. His creation, even in its fallen state, cries out that there's a creator. We look at the plants and things and see how everything is just working together. That couldn't have come by accident. We know that. God's a God of purpose. And as we see that, as we understand that, we're convinced even more and more that God is a God of purpose, that there's not a thing called chance. Evolutionists, they'll spend the rest of their days hollering evolution, evolution, evolution. It's still only a theory. It never will be a fact because evolution doesn't exist. God help us to understand that. It's my prayer for Christ's sake.